Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
So we shied away from calling the victory at Leicester a big win, but if Saturday's 3 points at Stamford Bridge wasn't a big win, then I just don't know what is anymore. A solid performance in more ways than one, and a great result heading into Tuesday's Champions League tie with PSG and that dreaded trip to Anfield next weekend. This is Why Always Us, your Manchester City podcast from The Athletic. I'm David Mooney. Sam Lee's here also. Hi, Sam.
Morning.
How you doing? Morning. Where are you? In Paris?
Yeah, it's mid-afternoon in Paris, isn't it?
But yeah.
Morning is a state of mind. Oh, there's blue sky now. There's blue sky.
Excellent.
I was not prepared. I did not pack for the weather in Paris this morning.
Amazing.
I'm basically staying in my hotel until it changes.
Good. Well, we'll get more from that later on. That giggle you could hear there was our guest for this week as well. We're joined by former City centre-back and all-round podcasting master, I must say, Nedim Anua.
Good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Not too bad. How are you, Nedim?
Yeah, Trebian. That's what they say, isn't it? Isn't that right, Sam? Now,
yeah. That's what they were saying. Although in English earlier, they explained that there's no towels in the hotel until this afternoon. So, okay, not very Trebian so far.
Yeah.
Things can only get better. That's where this podcast comes in.
That's the extent of my French as well, and I did French A level. So let's leave that there quite quickly, shall we? You can sign up to The Athletic right now and read all of Sam's stuff on City. And if you sign up now, you can get 33% off the price of a full subscription. Just go to theathletic.com/ManCityPod. Let's start with that performance at Chelsea then at the weekend, because Sam, me and you were chatting just after the game, and I couldn't really decide if Chelsea offered nothing and their tactics were very negative, because and then afterwards Tuchel said that basically City didn't let them play. So which was it? Chelsea bad, City good, bit of both? What you thought?
It was definitely both. Like, Chelsea's setup was unusual, considering. I don't know, maybe we've overblown the kind of tactical victories that Tuchel got over Guardiola in the past. I know they didn't necessarily deserve to win all of those three games, but ultimately, in the final, they definitely did. So it was strange that they set up that way, in a way that didn't really allow them many options to get out. And even when there were options, it was normally Kante having to bring the ball forward or play the pass forward, which he's very good at many things, and he's got better at going forward, but that's still not the guy you'd want there, especially in that squad with other options available. But that said, City were great at like really compounding that. And yeah, my analysis I did at half time was Chelsea can't get out, but City can't get in. And that was kind of how the first half went, because City was so good at stopping Chelsea, and they won the ball back about 30, 35 yards from the Chelsea goal so often, a bit like Southampton did against City last weekend. So it was a great performance in that sense. And the second half was a great performance in a different sense, but it was definitely a bit of both. Well, I'm sure Nedim will tell me I'm wrong, but
No.
Listen, it was definitely a bit of both in my opinion.
No, every one of our conversations starts off with me saying that you're wrong. Like, a few of them do, but not everything.
Many of them do, don't they, Nedim? That's true.
To be fair, like, since I've been back in England, I've enjoyed speaking with Sam, because we sort of like pick each other's brains about certain things. You know, sometimes I see something, sometimes he sees something, and we are added to this whole picture. And we've been going back and forth for probably the last month or so about what City's season is and what the team's like and so on. And when you look at, for me anyway, when you look at that Chelsea game, to put you into a different perspective, because so they played City four times last year. Is that right? Four times?
Yeah.
With Tuchel. Okay.
One was Lampard.
Yeah, so the first one with Lampard was like, you know, we tend to disregard it, but that was one of the first times where City went without a true striker in the game, and that was going to become the norm. And I thought they played quite well in that game because they controlled it. Then there was the FA Cup game, I think, where City made a host of changes. Then there was the next game where City put out every possible attacker that was alive at the club and they put them across the front line and midfield. So that, again, that wasn't normal City. And then when we talk about the I don't want to talk about the Champions League. Like, so I don't think this is a separate take, but within that, there's always talk about Fernandinho playing, and, you know, because he played so well in the semi-final, all that stuff. Like, I get it. But I always refer back to, in that game, there were some City players who probably had their worst game of the season, and they were in their normal spots. So when I look at that, tactically, like, Chelsea were good, but for City, you know, tactically, there's that element there. But there was some players just didn't perform, you know. So when all things are equal, if certain City players would have performed better, in my opinion, during that game, whether Gundogan was in a six or not, I think the game could have been more competitive and they could have created more. If maybe Phil took his chance, which was blocked by Rudiger, say in the first half or something, then maybe it goes in a different direction. So, you know, tactically, like I say, it seemed like Tuchel may have one-upped him. But then from a performance standpoint, like, I think that was the bigger thing. So then going into this game here, this is how I see it. So Tuchel went for the three in midfield because he probably thought City are going to have a ton of players in there. And if you have three players in midfield, then at least you've got half a chance of trying to win some sort of midfield battle. Maybe you can control the game a bit more. So he tried it. But City still had 1,000 players in there. As Sam was alluding to there, the amount of times they won the ball up high is because for Chelsea, like, they're a great team, but they are predictable in terms of how they play. The ball goes here, the ball goes here, the ball goes here. And that's not a weakness. You know, that's a strength that they have because so far nobody stopped it. But how do you stop it now when Jorginho gets the ball and has got four players around him? And he rolls it to Kovacic, he's got four players around him. And then he rolls it to Kante, he's got three, four players around him. You know, you don't see the game in the same manner when their body's constantly around you. And so as a consequence, with City, with the extra bodies they had in there, it was a lot easier for them to control a game against a side who were reluctant to just go long, go back to front as often as they can, because they also like to control games. And, you know, that's hard. That's a tough position to be in because you have your beliefs. If you want to play, then great, you can try and play. But try and play when... Now, like, you're outnumbered in key areas. And you can see, they struggled off the back here and they could never go into a flow. And then to add to that, sorry I'm ranting now, but to add to that, there's certain teams you play against where the best thing to do is to not allow them to get into their flow from the get-go. But Chelsea, their press seemed to start around the halfway line. So for the first 10, 15 minutes of the game, City were able to move the ball left and right, back and forth and so on. And they got into a groove. At the moment they got into a groove, like, City are a very hard team to break out of that. So I think Chelsea could have been more aggressive at the start. But aside from that, I think just the way that City played and the way that they set up like that, as I said to Sam a few times recently, some of the best performances I've seen from Man City in my lifetime have come without a striker because they can control the game in a way which I've not seen. And the way they played against Chelsea away there, I don't see any other team in the Premier League being able to do that, which is why when I look at it, I sometimes wonder to myself, like, maybe this is the best version of City when they play in this way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other thing, Sam, I don't know if you saw the memes that have been going around Twitter this weekend. The meme has been, you're in her DMs while I'm whatever. The one I saw for the City was a picture of Rodri that just said, you're in her DMs, I am the DM. And it just it just summed up Rodri's performance. He was fantastic.
Yeah, it was really good. It was one of those where the kind of scatterbrain notes I make during the game on Google Docs, like the first few were like, Rodri's looking good. Like, I could, if I'd have been more prepared, I'd have got the notes up. But I like a few minutes in, Kante was trying to break away and he just went, no, shrugged him off. It came forward. Obviously, he was always in the right position to kind of get the ball. You know, when I talked about City winning the ball back at 35 yards from the Chelsea goal, it was normally the players ahead of him putting the guy under pressure and then he'd be there to mop it up. There was a few times when he was like a wildebeest or something, being mobbed by like two or three lions. And it, genuinely, there was like two or three Chelsea players. Some of them were trying to like jump around him, grab at him as he was carrying the ball, but he managed to hold him off, lay it off. And then I suppose if you contrast that to kind of Fernandinho, I suppose, in the similar kind of pressure against Southampton last week and how he struggled, not that it means anything outside of those two particular performances and those two particular games. But I thought that was a big contrast. And yeah, Rodri... Like, for example, I thought Rodri stood out as having, like, a really good game early on, whereas Bernardo, in my opinion, I know other people spotted it sooner, but it was about 5 minutes into the second half and I was, oh, Bernardo's having a really good game. But straight away, everything Rodri did was like, oh, that's noticeably good. And I think the difference is probably that with Rodri, you're never quite sure. Like, there's no guarantee that he's going to stop somebody on a transition, is there? There's no guarantee that he's going to, I don't know, maybe shrug somebody off when he's under pressure. But he did that and it really stood out. And it's one of those where you could highlight every City player. You certainly couldn't pick a fault in any of them, really. But yeah. Rodri in particular was very good.
Let's talk strikers, Nedim, because as much as you say this is the best incarnation of City, or one of the best incarnations of City,
could be,
right?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah, there
is still the fact that Grealish missed a chance, the Jesus had one cleared off the line, the goal did come from a deflection. It was okay, you need that little bit of luck sometimes, and they didn't get that luck against Southampton, but they did against Chelsea. Does a number nine just simply make those problems go away, or does it take a body out of the midfield that they've been using so well elsewhere?
So this is what gets me, yeah. And I think this weekend kind of summarized it perfectly. So in Chelsea and Man United, they've got two of the best nines or whatever in the world. Neither of them scored a goal this weekend. Chelsea didn't have a shot on target this weekend with Lukaku and Werner behind him or whatever. Ronaldo didn't score. City, I speak to Sam about this all the time. A striker, yes, he's proven is more clinical, but a striker does not take 100% of all their chances anyway. Otherwise, every striker, like the top ones, would be scoring 40 a season in the league, and they don't do that. They literally don't do that. You could definitely argue that City's forward line could be more clinical, but then you look at the chances that they're able to create, and these guys still end up with 10, 15 goals a season anyway, which I think carries more weight than, say, having a true reliance on just one person to score the majority of their goals. So I see it. But then if I pictured that Chelsea game there and I thought if, for example, they had a Harry Kane in there, would they be able to control the game in the way in which they did? And I thought to myself, no, I don't think they can. But then when you're able to control the game, then the destiny, it feels like the result itself is now going to be down to you. Can you take a chance? And for City, like they had more attempts on goal and more shots on target than Chelsea with a striker who cost £100 million. So which one do you think is essentially more important? Having a striker on the field to maybe sniff out a chance or having players on the field who can, you know, generate opportunities and control the pace of the game?
To our service, that we had a similar chat about Ronaldo, though, didn't we? And I don't know if I could summarize it, but I was like, well, basically, Ronaldo at United doesn't solve any problems because their problems are kind of in the kitchen, as it were. And you need the waiter to bring the food out of the kitchen to... I'm going to mix the metaphor now, put it in the box. But like that was Chelsea's problem as well, because they didn't have any service. But at City, if you give, let's say, Lukaku or Ronaldo, let's say they had either of them, if you give them service, which 99 times out of 100 you're going to get in the City team, then you've got a different beast. But this is a really interesting conversation, and I think we slipped into this conversation really casually, but it's probably the first time I reckon that this has really been added to the kind of discourse around City needing a striker. Not just that they're fine without one because they did all this, that and the other last season, or that they definitely need one because of this chance or that chance and the flaws that can be picked in those arguments. There is an argument that they are better without one, and this is the argument. What I think, and it's similar to what I was saying last year, when people were kind of saying, because it's funny actually, at the start of the year, if you remember, people were saying, well, City don't need a striker. You know, when Aguero was out and Jesus wasn't really playing, people were actually arguing back then. It was sort of the opposite to now. People saying, oh, they don't really need one. And I was like, well, it's just another option, isn't it? Like in 2018-19, and basically once Aguero had learned exactly what Guardiola wanted or just did whatever Guardiola wanted or whatever, he was in. He did play. They did play with a striker. They did play great football. And it's basically, I think if you've got that figurehead, it's another option. But I really do get the point that, I'm going to go back a second actually, because I wrote an article about needing a striker or not at the weekend. And I kind of highlighted, I was like, well, you know, would the fact that City had Kane, for argument's sake, stop Grealish from missing a chance or Foden from missing a chance, or, you know, Jesus and Sterling with their big chance conversion rate, you know, that's not going to improve anyway, which people don't seem to talk about. And then I said, in terms of the false nine, I was like, well, Guardiola hasn't used one recently. No, sorry, he's used a false nine recently, but he's only really used one when he's not had a proper striker, because he dropped Aguero in the first 18 months of Guardiola being in charge for like Barca game, United game, probably some others when he wanted more pressing and that kind of stuff. But as soon as Aguero was that man, then he brought him back in. And then when he stopped being that man in the last year when he was injured, he took him back out. So the point I made was Guardiola likes a striker, and they'll play a striker if they get one. And he definitely does want one, which is obvious from his quotes at the weekend. But then me and Nadim spoke I was on the train back from London. And when I got back to the station, I called him back because the signal was crap. Because it is actually a really interesting idea, and it did make me think that these performances that got City to the Champions League final, that, you know, when City played, oh God, they're playing Haaland, how are they going to keep him quiet? And people were talking about Diaz or Stones or whatever. They just starved him of the ball. And they did the same more or less, well, for three quarters of the PSG ties, the two legs, they did the same to PSG. And you do think these are, like as Nadim says, these are probably some of the best performances in City's history without one. So it is interesting. And then I suppose you get into the realms of if they bought Haaland, would they drop him for a big game where they needed to control something, which is
this, kind of 4D chess. It's so interesting because obviously there's no right or wrong answer as such, but because of the way we've sort of been raised in terms of viewing football and the fact that we had Sergio Aguero in the building for the years that we did, you know, that feels the norm, and anything that goes against that at some point we'll revert back to what we think is should be when things are going wrong. But I think in some ways that discredits when things are going right, because those games will probably feel more iconic. Yeah. Like if they had a striker playing on the weekend and they played the same way, then it'd be like, you know, this is why you need a striker and this, that and the other. But it didn't happen. I mean, you talk about the PSG sort of like semi-final, the second game, like I thought they were incredible. Again, there was no striker, but they were incredible. And even like I'm still trying to figure out this particular take as well. So I think in our lifetimes, the best Premier League version of Liverpool has been in the last 3-4 years, if you disregard last year, yeah. And the least important person in their forward line is Firmino, because all the goals essentially coming out from the people who are out wider, because it's more about the forwards and total people, the totality in terms of other people contributing. Because yesterday, we were talking about Spurs and Arsenal, saying Aubameyang needs to score and saying Kane needs to score and this, that and the other. But those two sides have been, in recent memory, have been like unsuccessful. Even like Kane last season gets maybe the golden boot and the assist thing, and Spurs are nowhere near anything. You know, this whole concept of the nine has to be the most important bit. Well, maybe the conversation should be, say, for example, at Spurs, maybe other people need to contribute as well if they want to be in with a chance of being successful. Because, like, as I say, Man City and Liverpool in the last few years have consistently been the best two sides in the Premier League, in my opinion. So, like, what's wrong with that sort of model? Because even with Aguero, he was a nine, but it's a very non-traditional nine to what you'd expect to see in England, playing for a non-traditional manager in Pep Guardiola. So, yeah, what do you think, Moons?
I've been sat here listening to you both, and I honestly am going to sit on the fence because I want a new striker at City because I would like somebody there to finish off the chances. But equally, I agree with you that the performances without one haven't given me any form of any cause of concern. I'm just not worried when Guardiola names his team and it doesn't have a centre forward in at the moment. I genuinely still don't think, where are the goals coming from? We've seen them. I mean, I know it's Norwich and Arsenal, but they battered both of them and didn't play a recognised centre forward in that sense. There's no point in the last 18 months or so where, certainly when the going got tough and the business end of the season was coming around, for the whole of that run at the end of last season, I just wasn't worried where the goals were coming from because I knew City had a system to do it. And like Sam said, it was about the service for the players in the middle. And you've got, you know, as long as there is somebody getting on the end of De Bruyne's ball, which is, it might be Bernardo, it might be Foden, it might be whoever, there's a good chance City will take enough of their chances to win the game. And I mean, in a weird sense, it kind of segues into what I wanted to talk about next as well, because City aren't conceding goals this season. And so when they score one against Chelsea, and okay, they missed the chance with Grealish and Jesus had one off the line, you're also confident that City aren't going to concede goals at the moment. I mean, it's one goal conceded in six games this season. That includes obviously Spurs away, Leicester away, Chelsea away. One of the single goal came in the opening day. They've only let six shots on target against them all season. So, I mean, that like those stats, it's just mad, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Sorry, just to go back to when you said about the lineups and stuff, it's also funny as well how things have changed this year in terms of, my colleague sat next to me the other day and he was like, has Guardiola done anything mad with the team? And I was like, no, you know, just Foden was a false nine. And it's like, that's just completely normal now. When he came, obviously, when he started doing that and dropping Aguero, it was like the maddest thing in the world. But those things are completely.
Those days are gone.
But even if they lost, even if he had lost at the weekend, nobody would have said, oh, he overthought it. He tried to do this, that, or the other. Like that, the false nine thing is just completely accepted now. I suppose that's because it's been shown to work. In terms of the defence, I mean, they're just incredibly well, like they are incredibly well organised. And, you know, you talk about well organised teams, it's almost like a euphemism for a limited team, isn't it? You know, if you play like some European or African team in the World Cup that you don't really watch, you go, oh, well, they're well organised, but you're not really expecting much from them. But when you actually say it about City, I saw some quotes from Sami Nasri this morning, actually, just saying, you know, everyone is in their position. You know, if you're not in your position, Guardiola will like tear you to pieces or whatever, no matter who you are or what salary you're earning or whatever. And I know that's obvious, but it's just, it's as simple as that in a lot of these games. Like the combination of that and having such good players, you know, a couple of weeks ago when I was like, I need to start looking at City a bit more like, you know, like a Charlton fan or a Villa fan or something, and just go, oh yeah, actually, sometimes just the amount of quality they've got is the answer.
Just win the game, yeah.
If I mean, in the Norwich and Arsenal games in particular, they were just on a different planet. The Leicester game, you could see more of the organisation there. And okay, we talked about this, but Leicester had a few chances on the break, but it wasn't really City doing anything wrong. It was just Leicester being good at it. Mm. It was just Leicester being set up to create those chances. Like if you get to Old Brighton a split second late and he flicks it around you, you could say that's a problem. But if you play Leicester in a stadium like that, you're going to concede counterattacks. So, I mean, I can't put my finger on why City is so defensively excellent above and beyond what we kind of said last year, since Diaz came in and helped kind of galvanize things and make them a bit more. They do look a bit more happy to chip in and battle, which is very basic. But on top of that, it's more like I was saying about the organisation and getting the ball to the strikers at other teams. The Lukaku and Ronaldo's problem is they don't have great service, and Ronaldo's problem will be for a lot of the season that, whereas Lukaku's was that in a one-off game at the weekend, and it probably won't be. It's the other way around as well with the defence. They're just, the organisation is there so much. And just in terms of that willingness to put a foot in, we were quite close in the press box to the pitch of the day, and it was great in terms of the energy and the intensity and stuff. And Cancelo was really putting himself around. Like there was like three or four, it can't have been three or four, but it felt like it, 50-50s that he was just kind of bouncing in between. And it's like if people like Cancelo, who I still would say are defensively quite suspect, or certainly more so than a lot of the others, he was really putting himself about as well. And they've obviously bought into the idea again. And, you know, we were reluctant after the Leicester game to talk about how much it means for the season. And I still am, because, look, if City lose against Liverpool next week, we'll be talking about them being however far off the top and however far off the supposed quality required. But it does look like they've bought into this idea of, you know, they're going to go and get these results. You know, if we're talking about the complacency that can creep in that you can't really put your finger on when a team's won the title, I don't know if you can have these results, especially like Chelsea, if the players don't believe and don't want to run and don't want to do this, that, and the other. Like it was all there, and that kind of helps, you know, shut teams out.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX is Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Nedim, is it simply Diaz? Is it Diaz and who, basically, is what I'm asking? Because the image of him at the end of the game, I watched on BT Sport, and there was a point where the cameraman on the pitch Diaz was walking at him. He'd thrown his shirt into the crowd. He still had the captain's armband on, and he thumped his chest. And it just kind of sent off this message of, nothing is getting past me.
Mm. I wouldn't necessarily say it's just him, but he has made a significant difference because he shows like a level of desire in terms of doing everything he can to keep the ball out of his goal, which maybe some of these sort of big teams don't really have because, you know, he can just play nicely. Like for most of a game, your bigger focus might be just passing the ball as opposed to like throwing your body at shots and stuff like this. But to give City full credit, like we spoke before about how they control a game. So if you control a game, like in the first half, Chelsea had 30% possession. They had 30%, and most of that was probably around the back line, passing it sideways to each other. And a key bit in terms of how well City defend is they defend as a collective. So for as good as Diaz is, and he's aggressive, and he wants to make it as hard for the strikers as possible, I always used to say to people I play with, like, if you guys up front are doing well defensively, my job at the back is far easier. Because yes, I could maybe win a one-on-one battle and do whatever, but if you go and press a centre-back, then the quality of ball coming into the midfield or the striker is going to be worse than if you decided to just not go and put in that extra effort. And as a consequence, teams can set up in a better manner and put you under pressure. Like that's why, for example, set pieces and stuff can be so dangerous because it's an uncontested ball into the box where anything could happen. Whereas if that's in open play, there's usually like, if there's a right winger about to cross a ball and Cancelo might be stepping on his toes. And that way, you know that the cross that's going to come in isn't going to be the cross that he wants. Because it's had to do it in a contested manner. It's just trying to get the ball in however he can, as opposed to fully setting up. So yeah, Diaz has been huge. But then Laporte's been good. And the whole back line now, to be honest with you, these are good players. You know, they've got good size. They're competitive. And even Cancelo, people say, you know, he's an attacking fullback and this, that, and the other. But he does put himself about because these guys, you know, they're winners and they have to be at Man City. You can't carry anybody. I think in the past, maybe one or two people thought that maybe they could, but it's your job. Like, this is what your job. Like, at the end of that game, you've seen Aymeric Laporte taking down Lukaku. You've seen Ruben Diaz taking down Lukaku. And that's the sort of ruthless nature of the top centre-backs that you come up against. Because, like, they'll say, oh, it's man or ball, never both. You know, that sort of mentality.
And, yeah, and like, it's one of them, when I'm watching on TV, I'm thinking, you know what, that is a cracking yellow card to take.
Yeah, exactly. But some people, like, So I spoke to somebody who used to work at Bournemouth, and when they were looking for recruitment, they had like a hierarchy a list of things which they wanted from the centre back, and the like fourth or fifth most important one was an ability to defend. And I thought to myself, like, that's at Bournemouth, like, what's going on here? But then you look at, say, the likes of City now, and Kyle Walker wants to defend, Ruben Diaz wants to defend, John Stones wants to defend, Laporte wants to defend, Ake wants to defend, Cancelo looks like he wants to defend, Zinchenko wants to defend. You know, and they take pride in it, like, because for them, they're not going to score a ton of goals. So the joy that they'll get will be from stopping the opposition. And what does it mean when, say, for Diaz and those players, they're going down to Stamford Bridge for the first time in years in terms of not being a favourite for a game? People are writing them off. Going up against a guy that's £100 million that is, you know, I think he's a very good player, but people are saying this is going to be the next that, he's going to be the top scorer. And you stop him from doing anything in the game. I don't even know if Lukaku had a shot. And then add into that a goalkeeper like Edison, who will throw himself into the firing line. And, you know, to be a bit of a football pervert, at the end of the game, when a cross is coming in and a goalkeeper comes out and catches it like 9 foot in the air and just drops to the floor with like a minute to go, I tell you for a fact, that gets me off that. I'll be honest with you. Like, that stuff is, that's what I mean. So it's this whole collective, and it's those little moments. Like, Edison didn't have to make a save, but those moments there, they're massive for a back line, and they understand how it can just sort of like diffuse the whole situation. Like, Lukaku rolls someone in on the halfway line, think he's going to be going through. So no, he gets chopped down. That saves a whole situation. And I think that back line and the team, with whether it's Rodri, Fernandinho as well, and even like little rats like Bernardo Silva in terms of the way that they play, they understand the importance of doing certain things in certain moments to literally stifle the momentum of the opposition, whether it's going and pressing them or giving away a cheap foul in midfield. Because, you know, if you're going to beat City, you're going to have to beat all of them, not just one or two. And I think that, for me, is the key in terms of why defensively they've been so good.
Yeah, and as a fully paid up member of the goalkeepers union, I'm so glad you gave Edison a praise there as well. That's I do like a goalkeeper that comes off his line with wearing a gum shield, because, you know, he's not going to he's not taking any prisoners.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of the performance, Sam, and the result, I want to talk about the picture that's building at the top of the table, because obviously it's still very tight. We're still very early on in the season, but I was terrified that this week would see City with 0 points from Stamford Bridge and Anfield. Worst case scenario was they could, you know, trail the leaders by 6 points after Sunday. Now it's only 4 points, but it feels different, if that makes sense. Because obviously the best case scenario is that City finished the weekend above Liverpool and Chelsea. So It felt like a really big win in that sense. And also, it broke Chelsea's momentum that they were starting to build a bit this season.
Yeah, I think it probably just set a few narratives straight, really. And I don't mean to say...
For a week. Straight for a while. It's just for a week.
No, they don't. But I mean, it's in terms of how we see football, and I'm not even saying I was right all along, because I probably thought Chelsea were going to beat City as well. But the amount of... I did some other media last week, and the questions weren't just, what if City lose to Chelsea? It was like, what if City lose all three of these games? And you start having conversations along the lines of, oh, you know, is it going to, like, what's going to be there? Is it going to be Pep under pressure, striker? But straight away, I had to say, like, why are we talking about City losing all three games? Like, City shouldn't be an underdog in any match they play. I kind of get the concerns, but basically, in terms of how we view football and narratives and stuff, City dropped points against Southampton, Chelsea and Liverpool won. So therefore, that just conditions how we think about them for that week. And, you know, because Chelsea had such a good start, it's almost like, okay, well, they're the top dogs now. Thomas Tuchel's one of the top two coaches with Klopp in the country. And, City got their problems, haven't they? And all of a sudden, the changes again. It's, oh, yeah, City are really good. And, yeah, Chelsea maybe... This is why after the Leicester game and even after the Southampton game, I was like, it's still so early to know. I don't want to be drawn into having to take on who's going to do what and who's going where, because it's six games. And even after the Chelsea game, I'm going to say it's the same thing as I did after Leicester, but like more so in terms of the performance being so good. But there are certain feels you get in terms of, okay, maybe they're not complacent or whatever. But at the same time, if they lose to Liverpool, we're going to have an international break of, or maybe they do need a striker, because that debate has not been put to bed outside this podcast. And to be honest, it's not been put to bed within it either, really. Like, there's so many schools of thought on it. But if they lose to Liverpool, that'll be raging for a bit. It's just silly how everything, despite all this kind of advanced analysis we were supposed to have these days, and I think if I worked for any other company, that would be taken as a swipe at The Athletic, but it's obviously not. For all of that, like, we just, as fans and media, although we in the media should have more responsibility, we can't get past what happened at the weekend. We just can't do it. It's absolutely mad.
But for me, that's partly because, you know, I went to work on Sunday with a spring in my step because my team had put in this great performance that I was really happy to see the result with. And I just think it's kind of an extension of that. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, it is. And like, as a fan, I think that's absolutely fine. But like, so like, in terms of what I do and try to do, like I did, I'll be honest, I thought City were going to lose to Chelsea, and I thought it was going to be one of those performances where basically like the final, I wouldn't have been surprised by that at all. But in my analysis of it and thinking about it kind of rationally, it's like, well, this is still Man City. And this isn't just me trading off reputations and Guardiola's done this in the past and the players have done this in the past. I was like, if I'm actually thinking about this rationally and giving whoever's watching or listening to this some kind of insight, like you just can't dismiss City so out of hand, like, especially based off what? The Southampton game, when, okay, a game plan was executed brilliantly against them, but that can happen.
Yeah, Sam, when we speak, like, it probably stresses you out at certain points where I'm just trying to be 100% rational about something, because I'm like a fan or whatever.
That's the thing, because I think I'm doing that. And then I speak to you.
Yeah, because it's incredible. Like, it's so early in the season, but because it's news media and because it's every round of games means something, they have to talk about something and they want to like go big on something and they draw people on who have big takes on stuff. Like, I think we spoke off air before, but somebody was saying on Friday that City are worse off this year than they were last year. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how does that work when you brought in a player for £100 million and the people that have left were people who weren't significant in their run last season, where they played in every game but one that was available to the football club? You know, how does that work? But then some of it, I think, comes because of this Kane saga. There's a perception, I think, kind of like what you see with game shows and stuff, whereby somebody's sitting there and they've been winning money along the way, and then something bad happens at the end and they end up leaving without that money. So people feel like they've lost, but you haven't lost. You're just leaving as you were. But City leaving that saga as they were, they're leaving as the champions of the Premier League and Champions League finalists, and now they've brought in Jack Grealish. But people are like, well, you know, Kane would be doing this or Kane would be doing that. Like, if the striker didn't have a name or a face or whatever to it, and it was just City are potentially looking for a striker, the conversations would be far different than the fact that, you know, talking about Harry Kane, who scores a ton of goals in the Premier League. So, like, it's this is, as I say, that's just me trying to be logical, and it just, it's crazy. These are crazy times. But then we've got examples like last year, like City were out of it in October, November time. They were a million miles away from it. They weren't going to do anything. They were not going to do anything. Yeah, they weren't going to do anything. They won the league by multiple points. So why are we in September thinking, well, if they lose these two games, that's the end of it? You know, like, football is football. Teams drop points. That's like the inevitability of it all. Some teams go on good runs at start. Some people can do it in the middle. Some people do it at the end. It's very rare that a team, even if they appear great, will be completely dominant throughout an entire season. So why do we sort of like dine on this sort of like, yeah, they're struggling here, especially given the fact that for City and some other teams, most of their players didn't even arrive for the season until like 2 weeks before the first ball was kicked. So they're going to be getting better. Yet still here we are thinking like, well, not me anyway, and sure, not other people. But people's perception, like, City for me are the best team because their ceiling is higher than everybody else's. It might not be by a lot, but it's higher than everybody else's. So when they perform anywhere near their best, I think they can beat absolutely anybody. But this year, people was thinking that City's ceiling was lower, but it's not. Because I think only the way that they played against Chelsea, I'm seeing no other team currently in the Premier League that would be able to go down there and do that. Like, teams might beat Chelsea, but the manner in which they did is one of the most City things in this era that I think I've seen.
Yeah. Can I, just before we move on to PSG, Nedim, can I just ask you, did you know when you made the quiz show analogy that both me and Sam have applied for the chase?
Do you know what? I didn't, but I look forward to that.
If I'm going to be on it, I'll be hearing about that very soon because they're filming it like November, December. I'm in the pool waiting, so yeah.
I didn't get an audition this time round, so there we go.
Oh dear. Never mind.
They've already decided, haven't they?
Right, so let's have a look at the PSG game on Tuesday evening. Sam, is this important, this game for the group, given that the situation obviously is, you know, win or not, there's still plenty of games left in the group to be able to rectify the situation, but City have got themselves off to a good start as well?
Well, yeah, they got themselves off to a good start. Also, we saw that Leipzig can cause some problems, but, you know, City are too strong. But even if that were to be the case in the last game, it's the last game of the group, so there's a good chance for City to wrap it up. But PSG drew their first game. So there's, although it's a very interesting match in terms of how you prepare for it with a short turnaround after the Chelsea game, will he rest players? You know, how does he prepare, or how will Guardiola prepare for Messi, or will he not bother now? Also interesting to see what PSG do.
It's not the semi-final, is it? That's the thing.
If they were to lose, it's like, oh, right, okay. And I'm sure we'd start thinking they need a striker again. And
Stop it.
But if they were to lose, they've got a head-to-head against, sorry, they've got a back-to-back against Club Brugge or Brugge in the next two games. So you should reasonably be expecting 6 points from that to go with the nine they've already got. Sorry, the three they've already got to make nine. And then PSG at home, Leipzig away. Like, it's not... There should be no jeopardy in this. And I always remember when, because City haven't really had tough groups, have they, in the Champions League, let's be honest. But I always remember when there's two big teams in the group, and you're always thinking, well, if you lose away to the other big team, as long as, like, you've still got plenty of opportunities to win the group in the other games, and basically that's the situation City are in. So it'll be an interesting game, and high quality. But I would also like to see City kind of destroy them a bit because of the whole, oh, well, PSG have to be favourites for the Champions League now because they've got Messi takes, which is like, I'm just not sure that team can be organised enough to win the Champions League in this day and age when you've got three forwards who, for example, they're not going to be able to replicate a performance like City put in at the weekend or did to get into the final last year.
Do you think all three of them will still be there in the second half of the season?
What, do you think Mbappe's going to leave in January or something?
Possibly. Is he not on a free next year?
Yeah, he is. But I mean, PSG turned down 180 million euros for a season. Like, what fee could Madrid offer in January for them to accept?
It's interesting. But then it kind of plays into the whole conversation about how this is still so early. And for City, winning that first game, it kind of set the tone for the group in the fact that, you know, as I say, they could lose this and they could be second in that. They'll obviously want to win it because of the players and the club and the manager and all that stuff, because they don't really go in half-hearted anywhere. But I wouldn't be surprised if you made, say, a few changes for that game.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in preparation for Liverpool, but to just try and continue in that sort of mold of getting the players all back to the same level, because people have come back at different times, you know what I mean? Like, maybe Stones will play in this game and this will be his first football of the season, and it might be seen as a negative or whatever, but it's to be part of that process because he gets it. Every game does matter, but then there's a ton of games which you're going to try and play in a season. And I was on the radio with Gail Clichy yesterday, actually, and he said something which I hadn't heard before, but I thought was brilliant. And he said when Pep first came in, he had a big long meeting with the team, with the squad, to tell them about what's going on. He said, listen, one thing you need to know, you need to buy into the project, but then also know that if you want to be somebody who plays 45 games a season, this isn't the place for you. And with that, he's trying to say that, you know, I will rotate players, but I'll try and maintain momentum and be successful. And if you don't want to be a part of that, then don't be there. So it doesn't matter who the game is against, chances are it's part of the process. And I think this game against PSG, even though it's Paris Saint-Germain with Messi, Mbappe, Neymar and all that stuff, it's the second Champions League group game. And I think he'll treat it more like that as opposed to playing against the name as it is in this moment.
But like Sterling and Mahrez haven't played much football at all. And in terms of being the people who want to play 45 games or more, you would say they probably are, and they have been. Well, at least Mahrez kind of was at the end of last season. So it's interesting to see how they're going to be used. And like playing against Wickham is probably not going to quite cut it. So I'm sure they'd play. But also, this is a conversation for another day, possibly, but Sterling, he's just not playing well at all, is he?
Right now,
but to be trusted to be trusted to come in and play the first game of the season, on basically no training, is huge. And then he just disappeared until the Southampton game. So it's interesting. I mean, I'm definitely on the side of patience, but also he didn't play well at all for the last however many months of last season as well. But did for England, so it's a strange situation.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, let's kind of look at that in relation to the trip to Anfield at the end of the week as well, then, because Nedim, I want to get your view on Anfield as a ground for City to go to, because it's been, I mean, last season aside, it was 2003 the last time City won there, which I think was before you were a senior pro.
It's the year before. That's right. Yeah, so that was, I think Anelka scored, didn't he?
Yeah. So in your entire career, City didn't manage a win away at Anfield. And like, they changed managers, they changed team, they changed owners, they changed players. So like, why do bogey grounds exist like that?
Do
players get affected by it?
I think maybe some players do, but you need to be affected by it, you need to have gone in there year in, year out and taken a beating. But for City, they've not always taken a beating, but they've lost. So even there'll be some occasions, say maybe the first time you play there, you guys play well, and then you're unlucky because you drew or like you lost 1-0 or something. When you're coming back the next year, you're motivated to get a better result, but you're not thinking that's a bigger part of like a longer run. But Anfield itself, like, that's one of the strengths. Look, you take away the Anfield crowd and look what City did to Liverpool last year. You know, the game wasn't like, it wasn't like City smashed them or anything in terms of general play, but they smashed them in terms of the result itself. And that's possible because at Anfield, those players for Liverpool get energized by that crowd. I'll argue that referees will also get semi-energized by that crowd. And as an opposition player there, they don't make you feel comfortable at all. No matter what style of football, whatever you're trying to play, whether it's long balls, dropping deep, pressing high. And if Liverpool have anything to hold on to, if they score a goal, like it will feel as if you're 1-0 down, it feel like you're 2 down or 3 down. If you got 1-0 lead, like you're feeling like something's going to happen, even though like it's just football, it's on a field, it's 11v11, it's still the same sort of thing. But the setting and the way that they sort of go out to support their team and get after the opposition, especially in those big games, is why like we've seen in recent times where they've gone like 2 years or 3 years unbeaten at home. You know, we want to solely relate it to City, but they're not losing to anybody there. Last year was literally the exception because obviously City won, but they lost like 4 times. before that, you were talking about 2 years since when Benteke scored for Palace or whatever to win a game there. So it's one of those, you don't arrive thinking it's a bogey ground. But as the game starts going on, you know, there's an almost an inevitability when the final whistle goes and you've not won. But hopefully for City, those players who've now like left that stadium with 3 points and they're playing well, they'll go in there with confidence and be able to do it, because like that, the way that Anfield was kind of felt like what it was like for City for a bit going to Old Trafford. But thankfully that stuff changed, and I don't want to say when, but there was certain incident when
I was going to say you were part of that team that changed it. Yeah.
Listen, all this City team wouldn't have done it without me and that squad of rejects as we were. You know, if it wasn't for us, none of this would have been possible. So you're welcome, City fans. You're welcome.
Sam, the Anfield thing, I mean, we said a couple of weeks ago, somehow what will happen is Claudio Bravo will end up in goal again. Liverpool will boot three in from 45 yards. There'll be a contentious refereeing decision. Everybody will pack up and go home. It can't just be as simple as that, can it? Because we saw from weekend when City won at Chelsea. Yeah, but look at the performance at Chelsea. Why can't they do that again?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking there when Nedden was speaking in terms of what City can do. It's a result that kind of goes under the radar. And obviously we used the 4-1 last season as a reference point. I suppose some of the home games as well. But that 0-0 a few years ago, I'm sure City would be delighted with that. And if they relevant to your question, why can't it be like Chelsea at the weekend? It could well be like that, and it could finish 0-0 again. That's very possible, I think. It might be a very close game. The other thing is, to go right back to the very first question, Chelsea's setup hindered them, didn't it? And I don't think Liverpool's is going to hinder them. So there will be chances to transition through proper players who know how to play on the transition. And they'll be looking for that, and they'll be wiser to it, and they'll be better than Chelsea, because in my opinion, and this isn't a knee-jerk reaction thing from the weekend, they are better than Chelsea. So it's going to be a lot harder to kind of emulate that style and peg Liverpool in. But the most relevant reference point and maybe a more realistic aim is maybe that 0-0 game a few years ago, not in terms of the result, but in terms of the approach, really. Because I suppose the game on Saturday wasn't really a great game to watch if you weren't really invested in it or particularly, you know, paying attention to what was happening on the pitch, and more just kind of, oh yeah, this should be a good kind of slog.
I've seen a lot of neutrals say that they weren't enjoying it, and I was like, I don't really understand that.
Because Saturday was a great day of football, wasn't it? And I was looking forward to watching Match of the Day. And then when the City game came on, I was like, it's not a great game for the highlights, is it really? Like, it wasn't a game for the highlights. It was a game to watch and kind of absorb. And especially as I put on Instagram and said already, so close to the pitch, it just makes it even more engaging. So I suppose the aim will be, and the best case scenario, other than the 4-1, obviously, a more realistic scenario is just try and shut it down and do what they did at the weekend and see if they can pick off their chances.
Do you not think that's the difference, though, between, say, Liverpool and Chelsea? Firstly, it's like Stamford Bridge can be hostile, but also City can get wins there. But for Anfield itself, regardless of how the results go in, there'll still be some sort of level of expectation. If you're behind Anfield, you know it. If Liverpool are chasing Anfield, you'll know it. If there's still time on the clock, you'll know it. You know, there's that tendency. But then for the way Liverpool play as well, they don't have to play around the back and through the midfield the same way Chelsea do. So for City, the press itself could be important, but it might also be irrelevant, because most of their threat comes from, say, Salah and Mane trying to stretch balls in behind and stuff like that. So in some ways, you know, when you go up against Chelsea, for some reason, even though they had Lukaku and Werner up there, it's not like they were going direct most of the time into the space. But for City, if they allow space for Liverpool to be able to play stuff down channels and so on, then that's what it turns into. And then that's a high energy, high press, high whatever game, which falls into what they want to do, as opposed to what we're seeing from City. You know what I mean? So maybe that's why Sunday or Saturday again for Chelsea was different to what Sunday will be for City.
It reminds me, actually, when you were speaking then, Adam, of the home game against Liverpool last season, the 1-1 draw, where it started with Liverpool basically going all guns blazing into the space that City were leaving. It took City about 20, 25 minutes to get control of the game. And the difference, I guess, is that if that's at Anfield, then they could find themselves 2 or 3 down by then.
Well, it could be that way, but there's no guarantee that Liverpool will be scoring while they're on top, because they lost tons of games last year at home from points where they were on top and so on. But you just don't want to encourage the opposition. In the same way I thought Chelsea messed up by not going out and pressing City hard from the start on Saturday, I think if City start encouraging Liverpool to be able to do that in terms of stretching the play and finding channels, then yeah, it's going to feel long. It's going to feel like a really tough test, because that's, you know, as a player, that's the big difference, like, between having fans and not having fans. Like, the amount of football you've played in your life, training games and all that stuff. Like, for example, a corner is a corner, but a corner away from home feels like you're under the most pressure on the face of planet Earth. You know what I mean? And that's in any stadium, anywhere. So if you start playing in and they're like celebrating, throwing, celebrating free kicks and all this stuff, like, it can affect the way that you think, regardless of however good you are as a footballer. So yeah, I'd be concerned if they try to do the same thing to Liverpool that they did to Chelsea in terms of that really, really high press, because I just don't think overall that is going to work, because it encourages Salah and Mane and to a certain extent Jota, who were their main three players in terms of people who you believe could punish City. So I'd be wary of that.
Yeah.
I meant more in terms, sorry, I meant more, not necessarily how to do it, but just what City will aim for, maybe, you know, the way they obviously did do it and can do it, and they did it in that 0-0, and I just mean whatever they did that day, because I can't remember the specifics because it was 3 years ago. But if they were to do that, then I'm sure a lot of neutrals would come.
Cue the headlines after the game: if City don't win, Pep overthinks it again, or some nonsense like that. But it's just like just a game at Anfield between two really good teams where the margins are so small. Yeah, you know, the overreactions come in regardless, especially with like an international break after it. Like, how much can we overreact for the next 10 days before the next game?
I tell you what, though, Nedim, if City win, I'll overreact to my heart's content.
No. That's not part of the narrative. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to do that.
Right. So before we finish, I just want to bring up Nedim as well. Your record at Anfield with City is actually not bad, given City's record there itself. You drew 2, lost 1.
So what you're saying is I never won at Anfield.
You never won at Anfield.
Yes. Yeah. But
you didn't get battered there either. So.
Well, this is true. Looking back at it, though, listen, mate, I'm one of hundreds of players that have never won at Anfield. Like, it's definitely a thing. Like, you know, credit to them. They have the history and all that stuff. We might not necessarily like them, but, you know, there definitely is something about playing there which affects the opposition. It's kind of like an old school, the place in Salford or whatever. Do you know when they used to have a bit going for them? Yeah, yeah. It can get a little bit like that at times.
Yeah, but you did once score a great goal at Stamford Bridge, so I thought I'd mention that.
Well, I just wanted to say as well, as far as this is the perfect way to describe it. So in my career, I never won at Anfield, but I actually won a couple of times at Stamford Bridge. Did it with City, did it with Sunderland, did it with QPR. So, you know, that's just a regular weekend, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, let's hope that it's a successful weekend next weekend as well, then, shall we? That brings us to the end of this episode of Why Always Us. It's been an absolute blast, fellas. Thanks very much. Thanks to Sam Lee.
Yeah, thanks, lads. Cheers, Nathan, for coming on, mate. That was great. And everyone listening, I hope you really enjoyed some... Now, this is proper City chat, isn't it? And I know I'm an outsider, but this is surely what City fans want to listen to.
Well, you tell them. If you tell them so, Sam, then I guess they have to believe it, yeah?
I wish that were the case.
and thanks as well to Ned and Manua.
Thanks for having me, guys. And I'll be back on at some point in the future.
Indeed. We'll be back very soon. You can sign up to The Athletic right now with a 33% discount. Just use the code MANCITYPOD.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.